This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. In particular, this month is being sponsored by Lindsay Marie Tribette and Nick Martin. I thank you both so very much. And if you want to become a patron, you can do so at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
So we are talking now with Mr. Mark Brady, and you're in the midst of a snowstorm.
Well, we are. We're in the middle of Colorado, 8,000 feet, expecting up to 8 inches of snow tonight and tomorrow.
Wow.
So.
All right. Well, give us a little background on these stories you're going to tell us.
Okay. I'll take this from a Jeff Ritzman perspective, is that, well, my parents, you know, my home life, where my parents always got along with each other. We've always lived in a very liminal area. Two aspects is my father was an American diplomat, so we moved around a lot as a kid. So first 18 years, we lived in Iran, Indonesia, Taiwan, Philippines, which we'll get to, South Korea, and United States, specifically Michigan.
Oh.
Thing about that is we're always on the outside looking in. We're never really part of the culture, you know, we weren't grounded. But when we came back to the States, we were really part of the U.S. culture either, since, you know, most of my friends in the States didn't know what I was talking about when we mentioned a lot of things. And they still don't. The other thing about that is that there was a lot of disruption in that every summer we moved, or at least half our friends moved. And so there was no really, you know, long-term friendship, so to speak. Though we did have these weird synchronicities, like the lady who lived behind me in the Philippines moved to New Delhi. But when we got off the plane in Korea, she was the first person I saw because she had moved there the year before. So it's one of those small worlds, but big worlds.
Yeah.
But the term for it is third culture kid, TCK, because you're never really part of anything. So once I heard Jeff Ritzman, I may have been on your show, talk about it, is, you know, there's that sense of detachment, lack of being grounded. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that I'm also multiracial. My mom was Japanese American. She got put in an internment camp in Idaho and got relocated eventually to Michigan. My father, on the other hand, was from West Virginia, ran away from, joined the army, ended up in Japan, and then the Korean War, then went to school at the University of Michigan, where my parents met. And there was always that sense of not quite being multiracial, not quite fitting into any one particular race, and then also being Asian, there's that sense of detachment there. For example, in the Elks Club on the West Coast, we couldn't join because they were considered as colored. But when we were in Maryland, we went to a movie theater in Maryland. I even remember the movie. It was Magnificent Men and the Flying Machines. It was like 67 or 66. We couldn't sit in the balcony because that was reserved for colored people, and we were considered white. So it's just that kind of that gray area. My parents' marriage was illegal in some states until 1967. So, again, you have that not really being there, not being part of it, things. But, and also the other thing is my parents were into Edgar Casey, Ruth Montgomery. The people, you know, were big in the 60s. So that kind of carried on. And that's part of the reason that, I guess I've been open to these experiences and not surprised when they show up. So the most of my career, I've been a risk manager, so for a large bank, and so there's always been grays. You know, there's no black and white in risk management.
Right.
And then I'm retired now, so we live in, well, I said we lived in Colorado. We're on the other side, you know, Chris O'Brien's Mysterious Valley, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're on the other side of the mountains from that valley. We're on the Wet Mountain Valley, the valley that has all the various interesting things happening, or is the San Luis Valley, and we have incidents here, but nothing in the neighborhood that the San Luis Valley has. So it's kind of an interesting place we ended up.
Yeah. But
first story I wanted to share was one everyone has heard of, but I wanted to give my perspective. And that's the Phoenix Lights. And when we lived in Phoenix, Arizona, and specifically we lived at 32nd and Shea, which is right in the middle of town. The interesting thing about where we lived is that it's on the runway approach path. So we moved there in 1996, and March 13, 1997, when I was going out to my car to get some paperwork, and I saw I remember it as seven lights in the sky forming a, not quite a triangle, but essentially a flying wing. They were coming in. The thing that I want to note is that they were coming down the approach path that all the other planes that go into Sky Harbor come down. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting up there. I look up at it. Again, this is in the center of town, and it's coming south. So I run through my house, go to the backyard, and the lights had come overhead, going along. Actually straight towards the airport. My wife, who's an engineer, was in the back working on the sprinkler system. So I pointed them out to her. It was already dark. And so we both saw the Phoenix lights going overhead through our house and going towards the airport. The thing I wanted to note is that apparently, at least I haven't heard of it, no one at the airport ever saw those lights, even though it was a huge formation and it was going straight towards the airport, and they probably couldn't have missed it if it went overhead. And they were, I don't remember, so I can't say if there are seven lights or one giant wing with seven lights on it. So I'll have to defer.
Could you actually see like a physical craft or only the lights? Like outlining?
Only lights.
Yeah.
And it's been so long and my memory doesn't, I couldn't tell. And that Phoenix is pretty well lit up with all the street lights, so I couldn't tell if they're blocking out the stars or not.
Mm, okay.
But it was coming down airport approach path. It was probably appeared to be 2,000 or 3,000 feet in the sky and headed straight for the airport. So I know there's been mention of the flares over the gunnery range, but
yeah,
this clearly came over from the north. I ran through my house, saw it departing to the south, and my wife saw it too, along with thousands of other people.
Hmm.
The other thing that always mention, and you know, maybe it's because I grew up in such a liminal state, is it never really changed my life. I know other people have said they've seen, you know, other lights, but we haven't seen any lights since then, and can't really say that it's altered our life in any meaningful way. It's just one of those experiences you kind of look at and go, huh, that's neat.
Yeah, it's just an interesting thing to have seen.
Yeah, so, but I can say they were there, and it was definitely over the center of Phoenix. That's what I can add to this discussion.
Okay, all right. So where do you want to go next?
So, second story that people might find of interest, completely different aspect, but maybe it's all the same phenomena, but we were stationed in the Philippines at the time. And being Philippines at the time, the American Embassy in Manila was a huge complex because there were a lot of families where the husband was in Vietnam and the wife and kids were in Manila. So there was all the accoutrements of essentially a small U.S. town. One of the aspects was that there was a Boy Scout troop that the embassy ran, Troop 451, and two of the Marines in the embassy Marines were assigned as Scoutmasters because they had been Boy Scouts, and they decided they wanted to organize a trip to Corregidor Island, which is this island that guards the entrance to Manila Bay. Now, during World War II, it was the site of two battles. First battle was when the United States was losing the Philippines to the Japanese Army. It was MacArthur's final command post in the Philippines, and they evacuated him out on a submarine from Corregidor. And then, I don't know the exact dates, but several months later, the island fell to a Japanese attack. And then in 1944, 1945, when the U.S. were retaking it, a bunch of paratroops were dropped on it, and there was another battle, and the U.S. managed to take the island back, but, you know, with a significant loss of life on the Japanese side. Hmm. So right now, when we went out, it was still being demined, demilitarized, all that good stuff. There were stacks of ammunition around that they were still defusing and finding.
Yeah.
So our scoutmaster decided, hey, that would be a neat place to send a bunch of Boy Scouts out. So we actually went out. They have a hovercraft, or you could get a military vessel, and very informal in those days. So we just went out, set up our camp, tents on this area called Bottomside. It's a big area, all open, visible for dozens of yards. So, but being the Marines, having Marines as scoutmasters, they organized us into watches, and I managed to get the 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. watch. Not that there anyone really was going to pilfer from our thing, but that's just what Marines do.
Right.
There was another guy on watch with me, and he fell asleep. So I was wandering around camp and got to see the sunrise. And so, being a semi-tourist attraction, there were soft drink stands right by the pier, which was about 200 yards away. So I started walking towards the soft drink stands and the beach, and I turned around in the middle of the parade field. I saw this lady in white. I thought she was a vendor. So I went back and started walking towards the stand, looked back, and she was still standing in the middle of the parade field. So I was kind of confused because, you know, if she was a vendor, she probably would have hurried over to make the sale.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked away, and then I looked back, she was gone. You know, just literally disappeared. Nowhere she could have run because it was a giant open area. And never saw her again, so to speak.
Huh.
And then as a postscript, a year later, I found a book that had just been published after my experience. Books called Corregidor, Ghost, Glory, and Gold. It was by an American author. And one of the final chapters, she recounts going to Corregidor to do her research and starting to run into stories with people there running into this same phenomena. Apparently, there's a ghost in Corregidor. It's been given a name. Her name was Mita, and she's been seen all over the island. I just happened to see her in Bottomside, but the lady put together a series of stories recounting this ghost's appearance. And so I can say I've seen her too. And in some ways, you know, impressionable young mind, that was kind of spookier than anything I had read about, because there it was. I'd actually seen it. Other people verified it after the fact that they've been having similar encounters. So they're different stories, but they mostly revolve around person, since she was wearing all white, being a nurse and either being killed or captured, or, you know, waiting for somebody who had been killed or captured in the battlefield. And so she's apparently stuck to the place. So that's my ghost story, so to speak.
That's cool.
But the third listener story, and this is kind of a different tangent, is that my friend, Ben, this was back in the late 90s, she had a stillborn son. And that event happened in December 18th. Now, I know it really traumatized her, and she was having trouble dealing with it, and she actually left the Catholic Church because of it, because the helpful priest said, well, your child is going to hell because he's not baptized, but we can't baptize him because he's dead. And it's kind of like, that's was her break with the Catholic Church.
Understandable.
But, you know, like an event like that's very traumatizing. She's told me that it was December 18th. So one December 18th, a few years later, I want to say six late years later, I get this dream. It was a Sunday, and I dreamt it was her son. And her son said, I think I'm like you, I'm a late sleeper. So 8:25 in the morning, I get this dream that the son said, get out of bed and call Heidi, my friend. And she's given me permission to pass on the story. And so, totally groggy, pick up the phone, call and say, I just had this dream. And she's kind of like, okay. Then you hear the kitchen timer go off. And she goes, you hear that kitchen timer? I said, yeah. And she said, that was the exact time he passed away, and I always commemorate it. But I've never told anyone else the time, so how in the world did you know? I'm going, that was my dream. You know me. She knows me well enough that all other occasions, I would be sleeping at that time. So that was one of those visitation moments. But again, knowledge I didn't have.
Yeah.
And that it made a difference to her.
Yeah.
And as another postscript, I was telling this story. I was in a dream group when I was in Phoenix, and I was telling this story. And I mentioned the December 18th, and one of the ladies in the dream group just kind of got all quiet, and she goes, kind of got all whatever, got quiet, and then eventually asked me, and she goes, you don't know this, or told me this, she goes, you don't know this, but my son also passed away at 20 on December 18th. And she thought it was incredible. She was just there as a guest, and that coming in this dream group to hear that there's story of information coming after death,
yeah,
of somebody who died on December 18th, just kind of, I think, made her more comfortable that there is something past there, at least information getting through. So,
yeah.
Again, I think it helped her too. So,
that's good. That's good.
Yeah. But it's one of those, I think everyone has these sort of stories. Maybe I'm more open to them because I'm more or less grounded in anything, but. You know, I hear other people talk about these stories, so I figured I wanted to share mine just so people knew that there are a lot of things out there, and they shouldn't be afraid of sharing their stories, and your podcast is probably a great place for it.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad you did, because those are very interesting.
Anyway, I appreciate you giving me time for passing these on, and hopefully there's another person out there where this will help or not help, but they're always, it's one of those, life is interesting, you've just got to look around for the stories that go with it. So
fair enough, fair enough. Well, thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
And Where Did the Road Go would not be possible without the help of our Patreons, and especially those patrons pledging $10 or more: Allison Cook, Lindsay Marie Trebet, Nick Martin, Super Inframan, UFO Weekly News, Tim, 36 Dingo, Maria, Jennifer Campbell, Mike McGuire, American Rambler, Paul Buscini, Nate Syria, Anthony Sullivan, Kevin, John Rutledge Foster III, Eric Citron, Ben Crow, Janet Runyon, Andy McManera, Sasha Lorg, Matthias Sunby, Christopher Vaughn, Riker and Stark, Robert Groom, Sean Cosgrove, Jose A., Roger Gonzalez, Craig Cicernos, Kevin Schreck, A.E. Gaiaquinta, William Lovelace, Mark Brady, Chris, Ice a Hot Dog a Sandwich, John Eddy, Carla Mahoney, and Chris Johnson. Thank you all so very much.
Come in, come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that haunts my mind? Behind a curtain outside of time. Can you hear the ballet plays, the whirring of the world? Of the universe, venture calls and Tatriot, chambers number 1597, and counting, and counting. Can you hear the ballet plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the ballet plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear?
Have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com, and thank you so much for your support.